Ms. Melissa Goodwin. We have two cases on this afternoon's docket. First one is cause number 18754 CV Smith Robertson and Alton Lee Rigby Jr. versus Paul Hamlin and Tara Natalie Hamlin. We'll take announcements in that case first.
Elizabeth Brad for the opponents.
Quinn Bedlam Judge for Paul and Tara Hamlin, the applicants.
Thank you. And the second case that we'll be hearing, and I've got some instructions for when we get done with that, when we get done with this part, it's cause number 18566 CV Chisholm Trail versus Chisholm Trail SUD and Delton Robinson and et al.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Jim Allison for the plaintiffs and appellants, the Chisholm Trails stakeholders, for present and ready.
Okay. Jim Delafuente for all the appellees, for present and ready as well.
Oh, for all of them, including the city of Georgetown?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you. And if y'all want to go ahead and have a seat, we're glad that y'all are here, that we can get started. As you each know, each side is entitled to 20 minutes to argue per side. We're going to assume that you're going to do 5 minutes for rebuttal unless we hear otherwise from you. All of today's proceedings are going to be recorded, and those recordings are going to be available on the court's website when we are done. In our lighting system, when you see yellow, that means you have 2 minutes left in whatever portion of the argument that you have. When you see red, we're going to ask that you please wrap up with whatever question that you've been answering, and if you need to say something else, then you'll need to ask the court for more time. For the appellants in that regard, when you see that red, that means you could be eating into your rebuttal time as well. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to know, Judge, as counsel for the appellee, do I have the option to reserve the rebuttal?
You do not. You do not.
That's what I thought.
But right. Well, that's what I was saying. So, yeah, when you're the appellant,
yes,
you could be eating into your rebuttal time if you get into that red. With you, that it'll be time to wrap up.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. In terms of office keeping, cell phones, other devices that would make noise, distract the court, or distract the lawyers, please turn them off or put them in the silent mode. And then as a matter of other housekeeping, we are going to have two panels here. So what we're going to do is we're going to convene the first case, call it again for the purposes of the recordings, have that case, and then we're going to have to step off and reconvene panels. And so we're going to have about a 10 to 15 minute break in between, and we appreciate your patience. For those of you in the audience, we appreciate your patience in waiting for us to get a new panel out here. And with that, we're going to go ahead and start the recording for cause number 18754 Smith Robertson and Alton Lee Rigby versus Paul Jason Hamlin and Tara Natalie Hamlin. And whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Brab, and along with Mike Johnson and Wade Crosno, I represent Smith Robertson LLP and Mr. Alton Lee Rigby Jr., an attorney formerly with that firm. We're here in front of you today because after filing a motion to dismiss pursuant to the Texas Citizens Participation Act and presenting argument to the trial court, 30 days passed without a ruling, and so the motion was denied by operation of law, and this appeal followed. I'd like to begin by summarizing my three main points, which coincide with the three-step TCPA motion to dismiss analysis, and then I'll go into each point in more detail, time and your questions permitting. First, the Hamlins triggered the TCPA with their claims because they are based on, relate to, and respond to Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby's exercise of the right to petition. Two, the Hamlins did not and cannot meet their evidentiary burden to provide clear and specific prima facie evidence as to each essential element of the claims asserted. And three, regardless of whether the Hamlins could meet their evidentiary burden, the affirmative defenses of attorney immunity and the judicial proceedings privilege completely bar the Hamlins' claims. The motion to dismiss should have been granted. To return to the first step of the TCPA dismissal process, which involves the movement's burden. Smith Robinson and Mr. Rigby's burden. They can invoke the TCPA by proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the Hamlin's legal action is based on, relates to, or is in response to Smith, Robertson, and Mr. Rigby's right to free speech, right to petition, or right of association. Here, it's the right of, to petition that's been implicated. The TCPA provides the necessary definitions. Exercise of the right to petition is defined as, among other things, a communication in or pertaining to a judicial proceeding. Communication is further defined as the making of a statement or submitting of a document in any form, oral, written, electronic. The entirety of the Hamlin's claims are based on Smith, Robertson, and Mr. Rigby's exercise of the right to petition because it's based on their actions in instituting suit to domesticate a foreign judgment from Arizona in Texas. The plain language of the statute shows that these claims fall within squarely within the TCPA. But in addition, last year, the Texas Supreme Court in Youngkin v. Hines analyzed just this section of the TCPA, the right to petition and communication in a judicial proceeding. In that case, an attorney was sued by a former opponent in an earlier case and did the same thing that Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby did here, filed a motion to dismiss under the TCPA. The Texas Supreme Court analyzed the plain language of the statute and clearly decided that an attorney representing his client does fall within the definition of the statute, right to petition. Because Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby have met their burden to show that the TCPA encompasses their the Hamlin's claims, we move on to the next step, the non-movement's burden. The TCPA provides that, that the Hamlins can survive dismissal if they can show by clear and specific prima facie evidence each essential element of the claims asserted. In their original petition, the Hamlins asserted a claim under the DTPA, a claim under Chapter 12 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and various violations of the Texas Penal Code. To begin with the penal code claims, though they were asserted in their original petition, the Hamlins have conceded in their briefing that they are not asserting penal code violations. So we take them at their word with the understanding and expression of this court that we all understand that the Texas Penal Code, based on settled Texas jurisprudence, does not give rise to civil causes of action. As to the DTPA claim, the threshold issue with the DTPA claim is the determination of whether the claimant has standing, and standing is based on consumer status. And the DTPA defines a consumer as a person who seeks or acquires, by lease or purchase, any goods or services. But those goods or services must form the basis of the complaint. Here, the entirety of the Hamlin's complaint is based on the legal services provided by Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby to their client, MFG Financial, in attempting to domesticate this foreign judgment in Williamson County. It is undisputed that the Hamlins never sought to acquire any legal services from Smith Robertson or Mr. Rigby. At all times, they were retained by MFG Financial. They are not consumers as to their DTPA claim. Their DTPA claim cannot stand.
So we don't need to reach the question of when the judgment had an expiration date or whether or not it was in March or whether or not it was in May. We don't need to get to any of that because of the basis of the DTPA claims. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, the basis of their claims and everything in their original petition only addresses the actions of Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby in exercising their legal duties to their client, instituting the suit. It's all legal services. They are not consumers as to that.
But what if a lawyer knows that the judgment that they are that they're offering to the Texas court? What if they know that it's not valid? What if they know that it's, you know, out of date or fraudulent or some other factor like that? Would that make a difference in your analysis?
I don't believe it make a difference as to the DTPA claim. Possibly if there was a different claim asserted, and I can move on to the next claim that they've... So under the DTPA, I do not believe they're consumers no matter what actions are taken. But the third claim is the Chapter 12 claim. So that's under Section 12.002 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and that involves the filing of a fraudulent court document or lien in the property records. Now, Chapter 12 does not define fraudulent, but Section 12.006 points to the government code, and the government code defines what a fraudulent document is. And under the government code, it's essentially a definition of a fake document, one that is not expressly created by the laws of Texas or the laws of the United States. Here, the documents complained of, the notice of the only documents that Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby created and filed with the court that they actually created, because the judgment renewal in Arizona, that was all from 15 years ago in Arizona. And the Hamlins have never once responded to any of the notifications, and it's not even the most...
But this is like an abstract of a judgment, isn't it? Or, I mean, it's also the renewal, but it's also bringing that over here and having
it is.
Okay.
And the most recent judgment renewal from Arizona deemed it valid because the issue they're discussing is a typographical error from 15 years ago, and the judgment was since renewed in Arizona again, and that document is valid. As far as Arizona is concerned, the document's valid. At this point, because the Hamlins have never responded, no one's adjudicated what the consequence is of a typographical error from 15 years ago on a judgment renewal in Arizona.
Okay, I'm confused. You say, because I thought the judgment was in 1999, the original judgment in small court.
Yes.
And then in 2004, there was a renewal of the judgment that nobody's claiming was improper. And it wasn't until 2009. So what are you saying 14 years ago?
When that original document was created in, let me look at my timeline. So in 2004, the order recorded that the valid renewal date was May 25, 2009.
And it
it's possible it should have been 2 months earlier in March. So it was at that point when the document was created that the typographical error would have happened in 2004.
And did y'all provide us with what Arizona law would be in 2004 as to when a judgment would cease to exist? Is it 5 years from the time that it's renewed, or is it 5 years?
Technically, it's 5 years from the time that you went in for renewal.
So
we don't disagree that it would probably
be
the March,
not the May
date.
Okay.
Okay.
However, then, I mean, notice was sent out about that to the Hamlin. They never responded or contested that issue. And then 5 years later, when it was renewed again on May 7th, 2009, notice was sent again, and it was never contested. And again, within the five-year span from that most recent renewal in Arizona, trying to be domesticated here, notice was sent again, and there was no response. So the Hamlins...
After the 09?
Yeah, each time that this has been renewed, there has been no response, no argument, no institution of even asking an Arizona court or a Texas court applying Arizona law, what is the... Like, what happened since so much time has passed? Is it void?
You know when your client filed the abstract, what papers they filed with it? Was it just the last extension, or was it all of the extensions plus the original judgment?
Honestly, my best recollection is that it was just the most recent one from Arizona,
and
then the original judgment, but okay. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. Can I ask another question? So are you, obviously the TCPA applies, they've got to show their prima facie case.
Yes.
And if they do show it, then I know that y'all are arguing attorney immunity
yes.
as an affirmative defense.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your position that assume they could prove their prima facie case, that some of their claims they'd have to show that your clients intentionally tried to enforce an invalid judgment, if they could prove it, hypothetically? Are you arguing that under Youngkin or prior court of appeals cases that an attorney still has attorney immunity, even if you commit fraud? If it's clear that there was intent to commit fraud, would an attorney still have attorney immunity?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I go to the language of Canty Hanger v. Byrd, which is the Texas Supreme Court case in 2015 where they thoroughly analyzed attorney immunity. And the language out of that case states, a lawyer is no more susceptible to liability to non-clients for a given action within the scope of representation merely because it is alleged to be fraudulent or otherwise wrongful. And this state has made the determination that zealous representation of clients should protect, an attorney should not be looking over their shoulder the whole time in fear of civil liability. There's other recourse. If in the midst of the trial there was an allegation of fraud, you could ask for sanctions. Criminal behavior, if you fell under criminal, the state can still prosecute criminal behavior, and of course there's always taking it up with the state bar.
But how is engaging what would otherwise be criminal behavior anywhere near being within the scope of the attorney-client relationship? We can't allow, as lawyers, we can't allow our clients to commit fraud upon the court. How can we do the same thing as lawyers?
Yes.
Because it's within the scope of our representation.
Your Honor, I would just continue to point to the language, I mean, and even in Youngkin v. Hines last year with the exact same TCPA, and the allegations there was that the attorney acted fraudulently, the Supreme Court just stated, even fraudulent behavior, there are other methods to punish, per se, to take some action against the attorney. But here, what we have is mere allegations, no adjudication or support from any other court, and just their statement that the document is fraudulent, they haven't met their burden. And then we have the attorney immunity defense, and there's just other ways that you can punish an attorney for behavior. And the court clearly determined that it is not the quality of the conduct, it is the kind of conduct. As long as an attorney is performing the actions which you would perform in discharging your duty to your client, here Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby being hired to domesticate a judgment in Texas, and all the actions they took fall within the type of conduct that an attorney would do to do that. So it's not the quality, it's the kind. And this is the kind of conduct that falls within attorney immunity.
Can I ask you, what is the relief that you're asking of this court?
We're asking this court to reverse and the denial by operation of law and remand to the trial court for a determination of attorney's fees based on the statutory language. Any other? So, in sum, based on the plain language of the statute and the Supreme Court's precedent analyzing that language of the statute, an attorney representing their client falls within the TCPA. The Hamlins triggered the TCPA. Then, as to all of their claims, just whether they can or cannot prove all the elements of fraudulent, which we don't believe they did. They didn't even address any other elements. They didn't meet their burden as to their Chapter 12 claim. They didn't meet their burden as to the DTPA. And again, we've discussed the penal code claims. Even if they could meet their burden, the attorney immunity doctrine completely bars their claims. So for an independent reason, dismissal is required. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Pesnell. I'm an attorney with the Pesnell Law Firm in Shreveport, Louisiana. We represent the Hamlins, the Appalese, in this matter. First of all, I'd like to congratulate opposing counsel for doing their best to put their client's best foot forward in this case. Unfortunately, their clients don't have a leg to stand on, either factually or legally. Let me start very briefly with a recap of the facts. Ms. Hamlin lived in Phoenix, Arizona 20 years ago in 1999. She purchased a gym membership while she was there in Phoenix, Arizona. She didn't use it. She fell behind on the monthly payments. The company she purchased the membership from sued her in small claims court to obtain the Arizona judgment that we're talking about here today. At some point after that, MFG Financial Inc., purchased the rights of the judgment creditor under that judgment. Now, that judgment was renewed once in Arizona in 2004. We're not contesting that. I don't know if they sent notice of that to Ms. Hamlin or Mr. Hamlin or not. I know they didn't send it to Mr. Hamlin. They weren't married yet. But I don't know if they sent it to Ms. Hamlin or not, but she never received it. The judgment was renewed again in 2009. There was no typographical error in connection with the renewal of that judgment. The magistrate in the court that renewed the judgment erroneously fixed the date on which it would expire on May the 31st. That was the anniversary of the 5-year anniversary of the last date on which it was renewed. Unfortunately, in Arizona, when you renew a judgment, you don't get 5 years from the date on which the judgment would otherwise have expired. You get 5 years from the date on which you file the affidavit and renew the judgment. They renewed it about 2 months before it was set to expire. So they had 5 years from the date of renewal, not 5 years from the date on which the judgment would otherwise have expired, in which to take action on the judgment. They didn't do it timely. They brought the Arizona judgment to Texas and filed a petition to have it recognized by the Texas courts so it could be enforced in Texas.
Mr. Pesnell?
Yes, ma'am.
Why did your client not contest the erroneous refiling of the judgment when she got notice?
We didn't know about it, Judge. It was the judgment in the small claims court was a default judgment that was taken against Ms. Hamlin. She didn't know about it. When it was renewed, she didn't know about it.
She didn't know about it the 3 times that it was renewed?
No, ma'am. In fact, they weren't even aware when they filed the petition here in Texas to have the judgment recognized. They discovered that that had been done when they got ready to sell their house in 2016. The title company was doing on the work on the house, saw the abstract of the judgment that had been recorded in Williamson County, Texas. That abstract acted as a presumptive lien on any real property that the Hamlins owned in Williamson County, Texas.
Well, but what about the applicability of the TCPA? I mean,
I hear
you're talking about the merits.
Yes, I am.
But help me with the whether or not the TCPA applies in this instance, specifically the right to petition.
Happy to. I was trying to straighten out the facts first.
Sure.
The Texas.
Well, and if you want to do it in that order, then how does that relate back to the, like, let's say the DTPA claim? How is it that the Hamlins are in a consumer relationship with the law firm? I mean, what do they acquire, purchase, or lease from the law firm?
The Hamlins are not in a consumer relationship
with
the law firm.
Do they have to be?
No. We have never alleged or contended that they are. If you look at the Texas Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act, you have to establish consumer status, but if it is clear that the claims are based upon or are arising out of an original consumer transaction, then that's enough to establish consumer status and the ability to pursue the claims under the Texas Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. We specifically addressed that point and cited the court to the cases which show that in our memorandum.
So that's just a red herring then?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
You do not have to be in a contractual relationship with the law firm, and they never were. We've never alleged that or contended it. But that argument is erroneous as a matter of law. If they were consumers in connection with the original transaction, they are entitled to maintain any claims arising out of that transaction under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Now, you still have to prove unfair and deceptive trade practices or intent and the other elements of the claim, but that is a red herring. That is simply incorrect as a matter of law.
What cases do you have that stand for the proposition? Because your clients are not suing the gym. Your clients are not suing for deceptive trade practices or unfair and deceptive trade practices.
That is absolutely correct.
So how do you connect the dots from we were a consumer of the gym and bought a gym membership. That turned into a judgment. There's no allegation, I don't think, that I have read that the judgment in small claims court was deficient.
We have not attacked the judgment on the merits. That's correct.
So how do you connect the dots from we were consumers back in 1999 or whenever it was, and somehow now in 2014 or 15, whatever year, that we're consumers?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Our claims are not based on the underlying judgment or the merits. Our claims are based upon what MFG Financial, Inc. and its attorneys did when they brought that judgment to Texas to have it recognized and enforced. A month and a half or 2 months before they got a certified copy of that Arizona judgment and brought it here, that judgment expired and was extinguished as a matter of Arizona law. We have cited the court to the statute and the cases that show that, the Arizona statute and cases, in our original petition, and I think in our brief as well.
Do you have any cases that have allowed suits under the Texas Deceptive Trade and Practices and Consumer Protection Act to sue under Section 12.02 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code?
I'm not sure of your question, Judge. We have asserted two sets of claims. One set under Chapter 12 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. That's the Fraudulent Court Documents Act. And we have also asserted claims under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. But they're independent claims.
I understand
okay,
they are.
Right.
But I'm still trying to figure out how your clients are customers. I understand how they were customers originally from the gym. I don't understand how they would be customers when you're suing. The allegation is you had a fraudulent judgment that was turned into an abstract here. I don't see how they're consumers of that, and that's okay. Where I'm trying to.
Well, the Arizona judgment was based on a consumer transaction. The creditor sued the debtor to get a judgment.
And
that judgment, that judgment, which was based on the consumer transaction, was brought here to Texas to be recognized and enforced. It's still a judgment on the transaction that's trying to enforce the provisions of the contract or the original consumer agreement. That's what they've been trying to enforce here. I don't know if that wholly answers your question or not, ma'am, but I think we've addressed that point in our brief, and if there are other questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them if I can. Now, what happened was they took that Arizona judgment. It had been extinguished as a matter of law. It was null and void. It was not enforceable in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And after that happened, they brought it to Texas and filed a motion in the 368 District Court to have that judgment recognized and enforced as a judgment of Texas. When they did that, they represented expressly or impliedly that that judgment was valid and enforceable under Arizona law, that it was entitled to full faith and credit under the United States Constitution, and that it was entitled to be recognized and enforced under the laws of the state of Texas. All of those things were false. They were erroneous as a matter of law. And both MFG and its attorneys knew or should have known.
And can you tell me, Mr. Pesnall, what evidence do you have to support, assuming that the TCPA, we find that it does apply, to support your prima facie case, that they had knowledge or had the intent, having knowledge to injure
absolutely, clients. Judge. We have made those allegations in our petition, and we have attached the documents which show that to our petition, including the original small claims judgment, the two renewals, the Arizona statute that showed it was expired as a matter of law before they ever brought it here.
The Arizona statute is in there?
It's cited and, I believe, quoted in our original petition.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it is in our appellate brief, but it is in the record, and it is quoted to show that. Okay? So they took that judgment. They knew or should have known.
Okay,
it was,
so I'm sorry. So other than the judgment and the renewals and the abstract and the law, do you have any other evidence to show that the appellants had knowledge that it was a, even though the document on its face said that, or one of the documents said that it expired on a May date instead of a March date, that they knew that that was an invalid?
Yes, we do. If I might continue, ma'am. They attained a Texas judgment on the basis of the Arizona judgment. That was invalid, improper, and illegal when they got it. They knew or should have known that. Then they obtained an abstract of that judgment so they could record it in Williamson County and obtain a lien on the Hamlin property.
Let me go ahead and ask you again because you haven't answered my question. My question is there any other evidence other than the documents themselves, is there any other evidence that you have that the appellants knew that the judgment was void?
Yes, ma'am. The other documents that we have attached to our petition, as I was trying to state, once they did that, the Hamlins discovered the lien in 2016. At that point, they engaged us. We sent them a demand letter, informed them of the defects in the Arizona judgment, the Texas judgment, and the abstract, informed them that their attempts to obtain the lien were improper, illegal, and invalid, and informed them that the only property the Hamlins had at that time in Williamson County was their homestead, and I don't care if they had an abstract of judgment or not, that's exempt as a matter of law under the Texas State Constitution. And we asked them to execute a release and release the lien so the Hamlins could complete the sale of their home. They refused. Even after we wrote them a letter, the letter is attached to the petition, explained all of that to them, and asked them to do it. That demand letter was sent under, I believe the section is 3251 of the Texas Penal Code.
And they received that letter when?
The letter was dated July the 22nd, 2016. I believe the defendants received it on the 25th and the 26th, respectively. That's set out in our petition. And it's evident from the documents that are attached. Now, we asked them to release it so they could sell their home. They refused. They said, if you pay the judgment or you pay a substantial portion of the judgment, we'll consider it. Now, the demand letter was sent under Article 3251 of the Texas Criminal Code. We have also cited other Texas Criminal Code statutes, not because we're making claims under them, but because they show the bad faith, improper purposes, and illegal actions that were taken. Under Article 3252.51, if you make a demand, a written demand, for a release of a lien, and you send them a release, and they fail or refuse to do it within 21 days after the date on which it is received, it is presumed that they have the intent to act in malice or in bad faith and to try to harm the creditors. So there's even a presumption of law there on the intention.
Mr. Pesnell, how long after they received or you sent the letter did they go ahead and release the judgment?
It was several months after the date. It was not within the 21-day period. Because they would not release the lien, the Hamlins had to execute affidavits, serve them on the defendants, and file them in the record of Williamson County to establish that their home was their homestead and that it was exempt from the lien. That cost us several thousand dollars. We did that. After that was done and they completed the sale of their home, the defendants filed a release of judgment in the 368th District Court to release the judgment. They did not at that time, however, do anything to release or affect the cancellation of the abstract of the judgment, which was still recorded in the official public records of Williamson County, Texas, and was still acting as a presumptive lien. About 6 months after that, they filed a certified copy of the release of judgment in the official public records of Williamson County, and that effectively put an end to the lien as a result of the filing of the abstract.
And Mr. Pesnell, yeah. How does this impact whether or not this is a TCPA case? I mean, we're getting into the merits, I think. So let's get back to the task at hand, which is whether or not this is TCPA, sure. And did the trial court properly?
Well, the trial court failed to act, and so it was presumed to have been denied. And that's why this appeal followed.
Correct. So let's
but
go on to
number
that
part. One. The TCPA doesn't apply to these claims, in my opinion. And number two, even if it does, it doesn't justify the dismissal of these claims.
Well, why does the TCPA not apply? And after that, go to the attorney immunity aspect of the case, please.
I'll be happy to, Judge. The TCPA doesn't apply for several reasons. It is a slap statute. Most of the states have passed one, okay? And what it's designed to do is to prevent parties from chilling or limiting the assertion of constitutional or other rights by filing a countersuit, okay? In the classic slap type action, a plaintiff files a suit. It may be for slander, defamation of character, libel, or some other tort. The defendants then file a countersuit and sue them for damages to try and dampen their enthusiasm for or prevent them from asserting their claims, at least to the full extent. In this case, number one, there was no original suit on the merits. They filed it was a summary proceeding. They filed a motion through motion practice to have this foreign judgment recognized. Now, that is appropriate, but it is a summary proceeding.
Mr. Pesnell, I mean, have you read the writings from the Texas Supreme Court on what constitutes a legal action and what, how the right of petition, what constitutes an exercise of the right of petition in Texas?
Yes, I have, Judge.
This may technically constitute
and execute an attempt to exercise the right of petition in this case, but the Texas Citizens Participation Act was passed about 12 or 14 years ago, and the Fraudulent Court Documents Act was passed about 7 years ago. It's the latest expression of the Texas legislature's will. The Texas legislature obviously thought the two could be read together and could work together, and to the extent they can, the Fraudulent Court Documents Act is the most recent expression of their will. Now, if you read this, the Texas Citizens Participation Act, as broadly as the defendants are urging you to read it in this case, you might as well take the Fraudulent Court Documents Act, crumple it up, and throw it away. Because how will anybody be able to maintain a claim under the Fraudulent Court Documents Act if any time they go to court or say anything that's related to court, it's preempted or done away with?
It sounds like you could be writing some of the concurring or dissenting opinions on the early cases of the TCPA Act here.
That may be true, but be that as it may, I still think it's a valid point. Now, the Texas Citizens Participation Act is designed to protect people's ability to come to court and exercise their rights. In this case, it was a summary proceeding. The Hamlins never received notice of it. I'm not saying they didn't send them notice. I'm saying it was never received. They didn't even know about it. The motion to have the foreign judgment domesticated and made enforceable in Texas was granted, and that was done more than 2 years before the Hamlins even learned of it. So this suit couldn't possibly have been intended to chill or discourage them from exercising their rights, and couldn't possibly have chilled or discouraged it. They'd already completed the proceeding, said everything they wanted to, and got everything they wanted before the Hamlins even learned of it or this suit was filed. So I fail to see how this suit could step on that one or discourage their exercise of their rights in any way.
So, Mr. Pesnell, I'm going to get back to some of the writings of the Texas Supreme Court and from this court on the TCPA. And I haven't heard anything yet that would allow this panel to distinguish some of those prior holdings aside from the Fraudulent Court Documents Act. So is that basically how?
Well, those are our principal claims in this case.
Is that the Fraudulent Courts Documents Act is exempt from TCPA applicability?
No, ma'am, I'm not saying it's exempt, but I'm saying it's a valid statute that has to be given operation and effect too. So this court or the other Texas courts are going to have to somehow reconcile the two or decide how they work together. That's all I'm saying. Now, I don't believe that the Texas Citizen Participation Act applies, but even if it does, we have shown by clear and specific evidence, including the allegations in the petition, citations to authority, and this is primarily a document case, all of the documents that show each and every element the Hamlins need to show to collect under the Fraudulent Court Documents Act, and we've shown each and every element they need to show to collect under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, with the possible exception of consumer status. When I filed this petition, I did not specifically allege anything about the underlying judgment. We started with the attempts to domesticate it or enforce it here in Texas. That said, it was clearly a consumer transaction. If that allegation is missing or needs to be supplied, we can supply it, and we think that the court is obligated to give us at least an opportunity to amend and correct that deficiency if it is in fact a deficiency. The other thing I would say, though, is I think the court could validly assume that the Hamlins were consumers. You can be an individual consumer or a business consumer. But as I said, if that's a problem, we can correct it. To your point, Judge, on the attorney immunity, okay? The cases that the defendants have cited all deal with and all say that an attorney does not owe a duty to his opponents, in litigation, and that they don't, they can't maintain claims against him, the attorney. And that is true as far as it goes, but that does not exempt an attorney from making misrepresentations to the court, from perpetrating a fraud on the court or the other parties, or from compliance with the fraudulent court documents or the Deceptive Trade Practices Act either. The attorneys are subject to those requirements and obligated to follow the law just like anyone else is. And if you look at the definitions of person and who claims to be maintained against under the Fraudulent Court Documents Act and the DTCPA, which we have cited in our brief, you will see that that is the case. The claims of attorney-client immunity or attorney immunity are a red herring. This is not that type of case. The Texas courts have held over and over that an attorney who makes misrepresentations to the court or perpetrates a fraud on the court or violates a statute, they're not exempt from the law. They can be held to account just as they can with their clients. We haven't sued Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby because they represented their client. We've sued them because they went well beyond that and did things that were improper and outside the scope of any legitimate attorney-client relationship. I hope that answers your question, Judge. If you have anything else you'd like to ask, I'll try to address it.
Just in the reply brief, the Canty Hanger case?
As I stand here, Judge, I can't remember what that case was or what it dealt with. If the court would like, I will be happy to supply a memo or address that if you would like me to do it.
I'll just tell counsel that in boldface, opposing counsel has noted fraud is not an exception to attorney immunity, and in her argument made reference to there being other remedies for attorney misconduct.
That's true, but I think that case was made in the context of an opposing attorney or an opposing party who were trying to make a claim against that attorney for things that were done during the course of the litigation. I don't know if there were discovery abuses or what the problems were. It was not this kind of claim where there was a fraud on the other parties in the court or where we have specific statutes with specific elements that apply and that do not only exempt attorneys but embrace them. I believe that exhausts my time, and so unless y'all have questions or there's something further you'd like to hear from me, I will retire.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, just a few points in rebuttal. First, there's no evidence of lack of knowledge. So this is a lack of receiving these responses. There's notes in the record from the clerks in Arizona and here in Texas that notice was sent. There's no evidence that they didn't receive that notice. Two, holding that the gym membership somehow creates a consumer status is stretching the bounds of consumer status beyond its logical realm. At the time the gym membership was purchased, Mr. Rigby wasn't even an attorney yet. He just entered his first year of law school at Baylor. They're correct that there is no privity requirement, but there does have to be some connection. And also, in the original petition, the gym membership is not mentioned one time. The only actions complained of are the legal services provided by Smith Robertson and Mr. Rigby.
If the consumer status is the only hang-up, does he have an opportunity to replead under the TCPA?
I do not believe so. He missed his opportunity because the statute is clear that he needed to provide prima facie evidence.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, except for that I wanted to make sure of that before you moved on.
So. Yes. Regarding the fraudulent document, even if it was found to be fraudulent, Section 12.002 has additional elements that he did not address. Intent, as you were asking, Judge, there's no evidence of intent. And finally, the TCPA. I understand his point about chilling the right to petition. It's about chilling the right to speech. But every claim filed is after the party has already made their speech or petitioned. It's not about chilling this party at this time. It's about creating an atmosphere of chilling speech or chilling assembly or chilling the right to petition for the rest of society, for all. And last, the fraud exemption, Youngkin v. Hines. So whether Canty Hanger v. Byrd was a case that involved an allegation of fraud against an attorney, Youngkin v. Hines just last year in this similar case, a TCPA action because of claims filed against opposing party's attorney from an earlier case, not only did it fall under the TCPA, and the allegations were fraud as well, and the Texas Supreme Court said the right to petition was implicated, didn't even address the merits of the fraud allegation, and went immediately to step three of the TCPA dismissal process, stating attorney immunity covers that. There is no exception for case.
Ms. Brab, can you address Mr. Pesnell's argument that the Fraudulent Court Document Act has to be somehow reconciled, and if not, then that act would not give anybody any type of relief if an attorney could just violate it?
You just have to prove your case. So he's kind of stating it as if it falls under, if your action falls under the TCPA, then that's just immediate dismissal. It's not. That's where the movement's burden would come in, to put forth prima facie evidence showing intent, like all of the elements of the section 12.002. So they can certainly work together, provided you meet what the statute requires. You need to prove your case. Again, we respectfully request that this court reverse the dismissal or the denial by operation of law and remand to the trial court for determination of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this cause will be submitted. Thank you for fine arguments. For those of you that are in the audience, we're going to take about a 15-minute recess so that we can discuss the case and the clerks can do what they need to do up here. So we'll be in brief recess.